Great, so thank you for coming to this fifth lecture on knowledge possession and knowledge transmission.
Thank you, Ursula. In this series so far, we've been searching for a better understanding of our natural abilities to detect the presence and absence of knowledge. I proudly define knowledge in the classical Nyaya way as a state of mind that never deviates from its object, as Vakapastri Mishra puts it, or as the most general factive mental state, as our latter-day Nyayaka Tim Williamson would have it. In either formulation, knowledge is necessarily restricted to true contents as a function of the type of mental state it is. Now, that might make it sound like only pure logic and mathematics could be known, say, through pure deductive reasoning. But I argued in lecture two that ordinary reinforcement learning allows the attainment of knowledge in this sense. Empirical knowledge emerges through an ongoing interaction between agents and their environment, an interaction of a type that selectively stabilizes safely accurate representations. The acquisition of this kind of knowledge is accelerated in curious animals like us because we experience reward for surprise or expectancy violation, which drives us to challenge and therefore strengthen our existing models of reality. Last week, we looked at the animal foundations of our capacity to detect knowledge, starting with the sensitivity to sight lines and moving up to epistemic states, with a focus on animals that need to distinguish between knowledgeable and ignorant competitors. Animals like ravens and chimpanzees learn about the world in part by watching each other's reactions to it, selectively taking cues from fellow creatures who are knowledgeable on points of interest. Humans go a step further. We don't just watch what others can see. We actively show them things. We tell them things. Because we intervene on the mental states of others, we build a model of what they sense and know. Unlike other animals, we explore the minds of others curiously in interactive conversation. With a model in hand, we can harvest other people's knowledge strategically by asking them questions. We can also surprise others by telling them things they didn't already know. In this way, our species actively shares the work of finding out about reality. And today, we'll dig deeper into the powers of mind reading that make this possible. Humans have several ways of transmitting knowledge to each other. One way is to direct the target's perceptual attention to some environmental fact. And this is something you can do even anonymously without anyone knowing that you were the source. So suppose I'm aware of some salient environmental fact, for example, that there's a large spider now crawling towards your ankle. I can press a hidden button that will shine a spotlight that I've rigged up to illuminate that spider, capturing your attention. Or I could point at it. I mean, if I do point, your attitude, I feel like I can't point at anything now, but partly because, yes, if I do point, your attitude to me does matter in decoding my gesture. You won't look if you distrust me so much that you take the gesture as a prank. But as soon as you do look, you have your own independent perceptual way of knowing about what I'm pointing at, whatever your attitude to me. You're safely and independently right about the spider's approach now that you see it for myself. So I started out knowing about it, now you know about it, you didn't need to trust me to get there. I can also take myself out of the loop by activating your capacities for inference, transmitting knowledge through argumentation. If I can recite a proof whose soundness you recognize, starting from premises you know to be true, then it doesn't matter if you don't like me or if you have some doubt of my command of the premises or of the argumentation. My all-time favorite example of this is from Augustine's De Magistro. He describes the case of a worldly Epicurean who retains just a philosophical connoisseur's interest in the best classical arguments for the immortality of the soul, you know, those arguments. And he's you know, walking along outdoors, reciting them, and coincidentally within earshot of a spiritually open stranger. Now, if the stranger recognizes the soundness of the argument, he can come to gain knowledge of the speaker's conclusion, despite the fact that the speaker doesn't even believe what he's saying. He's, quote, unaware that he is stating truths. Of course, there's more mundane examples. You know, we could have talked about mathematical proofs, which convey knowledge to anyone who knows the premises and then follows the reasoning without need for trust in the person communicating the proof. The audience gets safely locked on to the conclusion by their own independent grasp of the axioms and the soundness of their deductive reasoning in following what is said. No trust needed. Hidden spotlights, pointing, and demonstrative proofs will only take us so far. Of course, testimony is our main channel for knowledge transmission. And now, at last, your attitude to the source agent is vital. You need to trust them to take their word at face value. So suppose you're curious about some question upon which I am what Sutra 117 calls a trustworthy authority, or as Vatsyayana puts it, someone who knows something directly and instructor with a desire to communicate it faithfully as it is known. Suppose you trust me and accept what I say. Because I know you will arrive at the truth, but you won't necessarily arrive at knowledge that way. If your trust in me is completely irrational, for example, if you trust anyone with my hair color, or indeed if you trust me on anything I say, including stuff about sports, then you'll be judging in a manner that does not ensure that you will reach the truth. If instead your trust were knowledgeable, if you somehow knew that I know what I'm talking about when it comes to the question you've just asked, you would be safe. If you know that I have knowledge on the point in question, then your complete way of judging this problem gets you safely to the truth, and my knowledge will be transmitted to you. And it would be marvelous if we had some general way of knowing when another person knows something that we don't already know ourselves. Sociologists of conversation observe that in practice, we seem to have something like this marvelous ability. We treat our conversational partners as if we had a pretty good sense of the zones within which their words can safely be taken at face value. Their epistemic territory, in John Heritage's terminology. And I'll be using epistemic territory, a person's epistemic territory, just to mean what that person knows. In Heritage's framework, our sense of this territory is our constant guide in whether to ask or tell, and indeed in how to formulate any particular act of asking or telling. He notes that this could seem to pose a challenge of, quote, daunting difficulty and complexity, but he goes on to say, in fact, relative access to particular epistemic domains is treated as a more or less settled matter in the large bulk of ordinary interaction. I think he's right about this, both that it's a problem of daunting complexity and that it's usually treated as settled, and the huge question is how? How are we doing this? Today, I'm going to be arguing that epistemic territory is generally mapped by the same domain general learning mechanisms that are responsible for other types of intuitive cognition, such as face recognition. In lecture two, I argued that ordinary reinforcement learning processes work to create factive states of mind, representational states that owe their existence to the truth of their contents. Today, I'm going to be saying more about how that works, and I'm going to be extending the picture from capacities like face recognition up to knowledge recognition. Knowledge recognition is just going to come in at the very end, but you'll see it's exactly parallel to face recognition, so we'll have done all the hard work when we sort out faces. Along the way, I aim to shed some light on the safety condition on knowledge. That I think you asked about last time. The safety condition is supposed to separate knowledge from merely coincidentally correct belief of the type that we saw in Dharmatra's example of the desert traveler who has this coincidentally vertical hallucination that there's water in the valley ahead, or Plato's example of the lucky guesser who points you on the right path to Larissa. I think those examples are interesting in part because each of these people will give you great advice. It's really easy to see why we care about the truth or falsity of what people tell us and how we get feedback from the world on that frontier. Much harder to explain exactly what we're gaining from this stronger condition of safety that we place on knowledge, let alone how we're tracking it. The standard contemporary formulation of the safety condition is Ernie Sosa's, that you know, that if you know, then you would so believe only if your belief was true. I think I put on your handout also Williamson's formulation, which is a bit more complex, but couched in terms of knowledge, and I think preferable. Unlike the person who knows the way, the guesser could easily have been wrong about which path to take to Larissa, and the hallucinator could easily have been wrong about where to find a drink. Many epistemologists of different stripes like the idea of knowledge as demanding safe judgment or the avoidance of error in sufficiently similar cases. The brutal thing is figuring out like what it even means to have a sufficiently similar case. I think we can make progress here by focusing on a concrete cognitive capacity and seeing how it could be safe. And I'm picking face recognition, partly because it's a fairly uncontroversial source of knowledge. We don't usually doubt that a typical person can tell at a glance that a good friend of theirs has just entered the room. And partly because it still affords a useful variety of headaches like secret twins, plastic surgery, friends mistaken for each other at a distance. Having noted the existence of these problem cases, and maybe having experienced a very brief moment that they're going to make safety impossible, we're going to start with a focus on how face recognition works when all goes well, and we'll return to the problem cases later. An interesting feature of face recognition is that we lack introspective access to its operations. You can tell at a glance that a person immediately facing you is some particular friend without having any articulable sense of how you're doing that. And I'm going to suggest that the reason for this is because essentially the computational work that you need to do here is just too large for the bottleneck of explicit working memory available in consciousness. It demands the massively parallel power of the unconscious mind. After reviewing face recognition, explaining how it incorporates epistemic safety, we're going to move up a level to apply the same approach to knowledge recognition, which I think is actually an even heavier computational problem. So let's dig into face recognition. It's been estimated the average adult can recognize the faces of about 5,000 people. That includes both personal acquaintances and celebrities. Knowing a face does not require knowing a name. You can come up with, that Facebook guy for Mark Zuckerberg and you count as knowing. In fact, some researchers are going to count a face as known if you can produce any appropriately identifying description or even just press a button indicating that this person is familiar to you. When that person's image comes up repeatedly among distractors, a photo of a familiar person is going to spark an immediate and distinctive neural response in you starting about 140 milliseconds after presentation. And it usually takes you less than a second to identify who it is, assuming the face is known to you. And it's absolutely remarkable that we can recognize so many people this way. Human faces are broadly similar in their basic configuration, so distinguishing individuals from each other requires subtle sensitivity to small differences, where combinations of anatomically realistic, perceivable differences define a space of trillions of theoretically distinguishable possible faces. To complicate matters further, photographs or percepts of a single individual exhibit large differences due to changing expressions, hair, illumination, pose, angle of view, and so on. So we've got a double challenge. We have to be able to tell people apart, but we also have to be able to tell people together in Rob Jenkins' memorable phrase. And if you've got a handout, the problem of telling people together is really illustrated in that. In that first figure there. When a person's unfamiliar, it's really hard to judge that different photographs of them, in fact, depict the same person. And you can get a sense of that by looking at the picture. My expectation is that no one in this room will be able to solve the puzzle unless you happen to know the guys depicted there, in which case it'll be absolutely trivial for you to do it. And that's a result. So Jenkins and colleagues argue that it's familiarity with the face that enables its recognition across variation, and that's a really robust result. It's confirmed with a variety of experimental procedures using video, live action photos. For unfamiliar faces, It can be really hard to match a target face with a simultaneously presented lineup of just like 10 photos, and no advantage at all when the target face is actually a live actor standing right in front of you. But again, if you know the person, then it's easy. The capacity to recognize, The capacity to recognize an individual face is a many-to-one mapping from a domain of possible percepts approximated by photos to a target identity. It's important for the capacity to cover possible percepts, because face recognition isn't just a matter of memorizing a stack of percepts or photographs and retrieving the correlated identity when you then later encounter some exact member of that stack. You've got to select the correct identity when you encounter somebody in the wild or when you see a new photo of them. So you've got to be able to deal with new combinations of expression, viewpoint, pose, lighting, and so on. Somehow your past experience informs a model in you that's applicable to new data. And the telling people together problem suggests that the formation of this model is subtly individualized for each identity. There's no single recipe for converting a frontal view to a profile or for predicting the dynamic changes incurred by shifts between emotional expressions. So in the words of one review, this is Young and Burton, the ways in which one person's face varies are different from the ways in which someone else's face will vary. To recognize Angela Merkel from any image of her, then, our brains need to have learned how to take into account this idiosyncratic, Merkel-specific variability. Fun fact about idiosyncratic, Merkel-specific variability. There is a German word for that. And Julia Staffel actually taught me what it is, but I can't remember. But you know, there's a word like that for each of us. This makes things very hard. But you know, if the exact variations in the full set of a person's images are unique to her, we still have some general patterns here to get going with, because all variation happens within bounds set by the genetic determination of human face shapes, the laws of optics and aging, and so on. For any given face, experience with similar faces is helpful. And this is true across ethnicities, it's true across age groups. So young children are best at discerning faces of people the age of their caregivers until they're about 5 years old. And after that age, humans are best at distinguishing the faces of their age cohort, because that's who we get most reward for distinguishing. Where am I? Enhanced sensitivity to what individuates faces is driven not just by quantity of contact, but also by social conditions motivating attention and depth of processing. For example, performance with members of another ethnic group is improved by a need to track individual identities as opposed to just tracking mere group membership. The various differences in physiognomy that are used to distinguish and re-identify faces can be taken to structure a multidimensional Euclidean face space. This is an abstract space with a zone for each face defined by its value for each of the various dimensions that separate faces from each other. And the dominant model is now expressed in terms of a four-node diagram. This is figure 2 on your handout, in which each face defines a recognition zone or cell anchored on a prototype, divided from other cells by bisecting the distance along each dimension between this prototype and its nearest neighbors. And that prototype could just be the average of the exemplars seen to date. Any point within the recognition zone for a known face is closer to the prototype for that face than to the prototype for any other face. And so essentially, you can recognize a person through changes as long as those changes don't render them more similar to another person than to the original. The overall structure of the face space that each person uses in recognizing others is biased by their own experience of faces, enabling finer-grained distinctions along dimensions that mark differences among more of the individuals one has encountered, where the selection of these most discriminating dimensions can vary by ethnicity and by age. The puzzle of identifying the relevant dimensions of facial variation is a difficult one. So I want to stress this little toy diagram on your page is two-dimensional, but we're really thinking about a very multidimensional abstract space here with multidimensional polygons carved out for each face you have to recognize. To see the depth of this problem, we're going to dig through ways people tried to solve it in artificial intelligence. So early approaches tried to hit a kind of compact set of dimensions that would demarcate the individuality of faces, structuring face space. So this is the kind of approach you see with Vicky Bruce and Andy Young's principal components analysis model from 1986. They're looking just for a short list of the parameters of facial variation that we must be relying on. So in this model, quote, a familiar face is represented by an interconnected set of descriptions, some describing the configuration of the whole face, some describing details of particular features. Those descriptions make up the face recognition unit, which is like a stored structure for each known face, and incoming images are encoded to align with that stored structure. When you get a match over some threshold, this activates the person identification node, which can also be activated in other ways, like by voice recognition, by gait recognition. You can even have a personal identification node for somebody like an author or a composer whose face you wouldn't recognize. So this is really tied into much broader cognitive structures. Now, it might seem inevitable that like any computationally tractable model of face recognition is going to have to work along these lines, right? There's going to be some set of descriptions that we're tracking, some kind of checklist we're working with to tell who's who. But decades of experimental work failed to extract the crucial set of descriptive dimensions that could individuate faces in general. So what we did find out was that if you want to go that way, you're going to need a huge list. So, for example, a model that starts by identifying 27 sort of landmark points on the face, which have some textural difference, still needs to have a checklist with 100,000 sets of relationships between those points in order to generate performance that is substantially weaker than human performance. So a model that's doing that, this is the Chen Kao Wen and Sun model from 2013, it scores about 80% on the labeled faces in the wild verification task, which might sound great. So this is a task where you just get two faces and you just say, are these same or different, same or different? Humans score about 97% on that. So this huge model is only scoring 80%. That's not great. We got a new approach with the age of big data. So Facebook's breakthrough deepfake model got trained on 4 million images from about 4,000 people, each of whom had posted a crazy number of selfies. Rather than trying, so here's the key thing that happened when you got big data. You stopped trying to figure out what are the characteristic dimensions in advance. You stopped trying to, like, let's compose the checklist before we get started. What DeepFace does is it's just trying to find whatever patterns it can extract from these images to optimize its performance in identifying the corresponding individuals. So the model is a 9-layer deep neural network. It takes an image's input, it outputs a guess about the identity of that image, and then it gets feedback on the quality of that guess. Early layers in the network are picking out low-level characteristics like edges and then hierarchically organizing them into patterns, which feed into locally connected middle layers, which take advantage of patterns that are found in different areas of the face. And then you've got a couple fully connected final layers that are kind of reintegrating those regions to take advantage of larger relationships in the whole face and to deliver this probability distribution over who could this be. The model as a whole has huge computational power, so it's got 120 million parameters or connections between its layers. And the values of those parameters get adjusted up or down in the course of learning to send a stronger or weaker activation signal to the next layer in response to the error signal. Now, the error signal of the model is, bear with me for a moment, the negative log of the output probability assigned to whatever was in fact the correct identity. And what this means is if the model was 1.0 certain on a scale of 0 to 1 that this is Tom Hanks, no correction occurs. If it is a little bit less certain that it's Tom Hanks, and it was in fact Tom Hanks, you get signal that asks the parameters to readjust themselves in the direction of what would produce the right answer. And basically, the less sure it was that it was him, the bigger a signal it gets to correct or update. So the error signal is driving what's called a backpropagation algorithm that runs down the layers of the model. And I won't try to explain that right now. It's an error signal. I'll just give you the bottom line that it tunes the parameters of DeepFace in the direction of ideal certainty about the truth. One reason not to explain it is that we ourselves actually might be running a slightly different process, maybe something like Jeff Hinton's forward-forward algorithm, but maybe in the end it works in roughly the same way. What you have is that the parameters start out as a blank slate and evolve blindly towards certainty about the correct identity for each image. The model's capacity to generalize well after training is supported by a special feature of its penultimate fully connected layer, this layer right before the layer that takes a stab at who it is. The feature is known as dropout, and it randomly switches off the output of half the neurons in that layer. So on each training cycle, each neuron has a coin flip probability of just being silenced. The researchers who originally developed this technique explain it as follows, and this is a Krzyzewski reference on your handout. Quote, the neurons which are dropped out in this way don't contribute to the forward pass and they don't participate in backpropagation. So every time an input is presented, the neural network effectively samples a different architecture, but all these architectures share weights. This technique reduces complex co-adaptations of neurons, since a neuron can't rely on the presence of particular other neurons. It's therefore forced to learn more robust features that are useful in conjunction with many different subsets of the other neurons. So if you add 50% dropout to a model, it takes the model about twice as long to train, to converge on ideal performance with this training set. But models that get trained in that way generally perform better when they shift from training to test. Dropout addresses a vulnerability that's introduced by the sheer computational power of neural networks. Because they have so many parameters, they're at risk of explosively overfitting their data during training, using their vast computational power to memorize the right answers for training set images on the basis of spurious correlations. So I'm going to give you a really crude toy example that's unrealistic in a number of ways. Let's suppose that all and only photographs of Robert Redford in your training set have some particular combination of two pixels that are two particular colors. Like each of your input images is, I think, 69,000 pixels. So that could happen. An overfit model that's just basically memorizing things could use that coincidence to identify Redford on that basis, because all it has to do to succeed in training is give a Redford for every Redford image. So it could just be using those two pixels. And of course, that's going to collapse during the test phase when we give it new pictures of him or pictures of somebody else that have that coincidence. But if half the final layer neurons are dropped on every training cycle, then identifications are going to have to be made in some more robust way. And only genuine patterns should contribute to identification. I know I'm cutting a bunch of corners. If you want to see sort of the deep side of regularization, take a look at the Mabasili-Belkin and the Zhang Bengjiao references in the handout. But here's kind of the bottom line. Dropout is one of a bunch of regularization techniques that are applied in deep learning to improve a model's ability to generalize to unseen data. Other commonly used methods include randomly adding a bit of noise to your data or stopping training a bit early before the model approaches perfection on its training set. I think what all of those measures are doing is they're trying to give you epistemic safety. Overfit models are brittle. By adding those two stray Redford pixels to a picture of someone else, we could induce an overfit model to misidentify him as Redford, to judge in a manner that could easily err. A well-regularized model, on the other hand, is going to be impervious to small changes in its input that are irrelevant to the target phenomenon. It's going to achieve epistemic safety as it generalizes well from past experiences to new cases. And DeepFace does generalize well, so it comes very close. It's scoring 97 on these tests, the human score 97.5% on. There is, of course, a newer deep learning model. Actually, there's a bunch more, but the one that came out right after DeepFace is FaceNet, and it works better partly because it directly exploits that abstract tessellation face-space network. So what FaceNet does is it takes input images and it produces a mathematical vector for each image that expresses the location of that image in a 128-dimensional face space. I know 128 dimensions sounds kind of mind-boggling, but it's a big progress from 100,000 dimensions, which we had to have a couple decades ago. So 128 is great. The goal of the model is to refine these outputs so that they cluster in identities. And this is illustrated on your model, on your handout. Training's driven by triplet loss. So each anchor image of a person X is compared to a distinct positive image of X and a negative image of some other person Y. And what the loss function does is it minimizes the Euclidean distance between the vectors for the anchor and the positive while maximizing the distance for the vectors between the anchor and the negative. If you give it enough appropriately challenging triplets, FaceNet learns to produce vectors that actually capture some deep underlying invariance between various images of a person. The recognitional capacity for a person sends all images of that person with any viewpoint, pose, expression, lighting into a distinct region of face space, duly separated from the image zones of others. Given enough data, that triplet loss procedure drives the model to tessellate its abstract face space so that the vector for every image is closer to vectors for other images of that person than to vectors for anybody else. And this model outperforms us. It's scoring 99.63%. I think you can easily locate epistemic safety in a model like that. Given its success in testing, its high-dimensional vectors are just composing a set of similarity spaces that work to pick out individuals. After training, a new image can be recognized or known to be of some particular individual. When its vector lies closer to the vectors of other images of that individual than to any vector of an image of someone else, so that slight deviations from the existing image would still be correctly identified. And that's the key idea of safety. To judge an image's identity in this manner is to judge in a way that couldn't easily err. You can also see how, if you're only kind of partway through training, so you don't have that perfect tessellation yet, judgments can be unsafe near the borders between zones for different individuals. I feel this way about all those Hollywood Chris's, like Chris Pratt and the other ones. Where are we? Even when judgments on central cases are safe, just as you might recognize the identity of a celebrity in a clear frontal image, knowing who it is when you see it that way, even if you can't pick them out from a dimly lit side view. So for this kind of like partially known face, even a correct identification in that fringe zone, it's not safely correct because a slight deviation from the image would map you onto another person, to another identity. But the fact that you've got safety failures at those blurred boundaries between individuals, that doesn't mean that no judgments are safe. You're still safe if you're in that central zone where everybody around you is a correct identification. So this basic idea of tessellating face space, that's old. That goes back to Lewis and Johnson, 99. What's new is that you're not calculating or supplying the dimensions of tessellation in advance, you're just letting them evolve in this huge set of model parameters in response to massive data through simple local calculations. So something like a triplet loss procedure is pushing you towards this Voronoi tessellation. To the extent that training converges on the outcome, the resulting face recognition spaces that you get have some really powerful properties. In particular, they satisfy the convexity criterion that Igor Duvin and Peter Gardenfors have argued is essential to natural concepts. So when a region is convex, for any two points in that region, every point on the line in between them is in the region. And you can take a look at the Voronoi diagram and see that, that those are convex spaces. And as Duvin and Gardenfors point out, if you've got convex regions, there's an immediate payoff in learnability. If you learn of a few vectors that these are all Tom Hanks, then you automatically know that everything in the space between them is Tom Hanks as well. So that's a really rich space of possible percepts you could have. The success of the big data approach makes sense given the complexity of facial recognition. You've got trillions of theoretically possible faces. You could compare them with each other along all kinds of dimensions. There's no simple laws dictating which dimensions will best separate the faces we actually encounter. It's only on the basis of the particular distinctive characteristics these faces actually display that the most successful neural networks learn to tell them apart. And these networks are able to do so because the plasticity of their millions of parameters enables them to adapt to the actual complexity of face space. So, what about us? Like, we know we are not learning to distinguish people by looking at 1,000 labeled photos of them. But you don't have to meet a person 1,000 times to have equivalent exposure. In each live meeting or viewing of a film, you see a person's face from multiple angles with different expressions. With the fact that these varied presentations are of a single individual being supplied by the context. You might also wonder about kind of like the starting point in human face recognition, about the extent to which our capacity to discern faces is shaped by experience versus innate endowment. Face recognition has a common cortical localization in humans and other primates. And that might suggest, okay, that's got to be genetically specified. However, we have similar stereotyped areas for buildings, tools, text, all things that emerged too recently in our evolutionary history to be, you know, encoded in our genes. Recent experimental work has really clarified the situation. So rather than being innately topical, it seems that object recognition localizations are determined in early experience by essentially geometrical properties of the stimuli. So it's actually the sort of combination of rectilinearity and curvature in the face that's putting it all in the same place in primates. Monkeys who are deprived of face experience early in development, they end up face blind at 6 months, and they don't show preferential looking towards faces. So it seems even preferential looking towards faces is learned from reinforcement rather than being innate. Assuming that there's some reward for detecting faces, sensitivity for faces isn't genetically predetermined beyond some very basic proto-organization for shape. It's just driven by the set of faces that you see. Or to quote the subtitle of Michael Accaro's 2019 review, this is in your references, it's a great review. What you see is what you get. Far from being the product of an innate module, face recognition works like the recognition of anything else. Quote, the development of face processing is guided by the same ubiquitous rules that guide the development of cortex in general. So it's just a basic statistical learning engine of the cortex, and it works to make whatever discriminations will generate reward. Developing whatever categorizations of objects and events can prove their value in the animal's pursuit of its ends. Okay, now things are going to get a little harder. One thing we have in common with systems like FaceNet and DeepFace is a wealth of parameters. They've got 120 million, they've got 140 million, we've got trillions. I don't know how many are devoted to face recognition, but probably a lot. And that wealth of parameters raises a puzzle and a problem. Because classical methods impose real restraint in adding parameters to a model. So we're now on page 3 of our handout. Yes. And there's some illustrations of the problem here. A first-order polynomial with two parameters is just going to draw a straight line through your data, maybe on a slope. A second-order polynomial with three parameters can draw a parabolic curve, and that might in some cases come closer to sort of capturing the shape of your cloud of data. You can keep adding parameters, raising the degree of the linear function until it oscillates as much as you need it to come arbitrarily close to each of your given data points. However, if there's noise in your original data, the high-degree polynomial that laces its way through all those noisy data points will have very weak predictive power both between and beyond those points. The complex theory represented by our high-degree polynomial, this is the C overfit picture on your handout, it's going to be unstable. It's going to require radical revision every time you add a new data point, because that data point's measure of random noise needs to be captured by the addition of further parameters, and you're going to have to walk around making extensive adjustments to the coefficients of all your existing parameters. What an incredible headache. To avoid such explosive overfitting, traditional statistical methods just restrict the number of parameters you get to make the model less sensitive to things like noise in the data. So optimally, traditional models are going to have just enough parameters to ensure that their expressive power matches the complexity of the phenomenon being modeled. With too few parameters, your model is going to underfit the data, missing the subtlety of the phenomenon. That's called the problem of bias. If you give too many parameters, the model's going to overfit. It's just going to be sidetracked by irrelevant characteristics of the given data in a way that's going to make it a poor model of the underlying phenomenon and a poor predictive guide to future data. And that's the problem of variance. And it was traditionally thought that you're always just going to have this trade-off between bias and variance, and your best strategy is just to add parameters to reduce bias just until you get to the spot where variance starts to rise. And that's called an ideal fit model. Now, the mystery is, how do massively over-parameterized models avoid problematic overfitting? Especially given that, in practice, they're trained to get to basically zero error on their training data. And the answer to this puzzle seems to be that the trade-off between bias and variance holds only up to a point. And something really interesting happens on the far side of that point. So the point is known as the interpolation threshold. And that's the point when you've got very complex models meeting very big data. There's a couple references on this, which actually I should add to the handout, Belkinshu and Mitra, Luke Varig, 2020. The interpolation threshold is basically the point at which the model's got enough parameters to memorize all its data. So adding more parameters is not making it more faithful to the data. What it's doing is it's enabling the model to basically give a better mapping of the underlying dimensions of the phenomenon that the model is intended to capture. So that big data, big model strategy, it's got absolutely no value when the number of dimensions you're after is small because the underlying phenomenon is simple. Whenever the observational data is generated by some natural phenomenon, which actually has the simplicity of a quadratic equation, your ideal fit three-parameter model, that's going to be perfect. Big data will not make things better. However, when the underlying phenomenon is very complex and we have data rich enough to reflect this complexity, over-parameterization becomes attractive. This diagram on your handout, and indeed this approach to the problem, is taken from a paper by Yuri Hassan and colleagues, which is on the reference list. They call this iterative optimization of neural networks a process of, quote, direct fit rather than ideal fit. So in their terms, an ideal fit model, quote, learns the underlying generative or global structure of the data by exposing a few latent factors or rules. A model like that has the power to extrapolate from a narrow region of data to the rest of reality. So in this kind of modeling, really simple equation like E equals mc squared, that can be found to hold very broadly on the basis of a really restricted number of local observations under a mountain in Switzerland. You do a few observations down there, and then that applies to the entire universe. By contrast, a direct fit model, quote, uses, this is Hassan again, uses local computations to situate novel observations within the context of past observations. It doesn't rely on explicit modeling of the overarching generative principles. So what direct fit models are doing is they're interpolating in between training data points by means of generic low-level methods like averaging, nearest neighbor computations. They can capture extremely complex patterns within that sampled area, but they don't extrapolate meaningfully beyond it. So if you think about how this would apply to face recognition, if you wanted to create an ideal fit model for face recognition, you'd have to incorporate all the laws giving rise to perceptible human facial variation, genetics, epigenetics, optics, aging, sociological rules about facial expressions and cosmetics. To complicate matters further, faces can be nearly duplicated in twin formation, scarred in hard-to-predict accidents. If some ideal fit model is even possible, it seems like you'd have to simulate the whole universe from the start. If it's even possible from a God's eye perspective, it seems to demand a godlike computational capacity. You'd have to simulate this like huge array of causes that interact in a nonlinear fashion. A direct fit model for face recognition, by contrast, can be shaped simply by encountering multiple faces with enough variation to make them serviceable guides to the rewarding goal of individuating individuals, differentiating individuals. So generative ideal fit models work by identifying the laws behind some little patch of data and extrapolating them to unseen data. By contrast, direct fit models work by densely sampling a larger range of data and just interpolating within that field. So ideal fit models are predicting simple phenomena beyond the zone of sampling. And direct fit models, I think of them sometimes as being like sheets of fabric that are pulled over a range of data points in some just immensely convoluted landscape. And then your additional parameters work to pull the fabric tighter to that complex topology. Okay, the adaptive character of direct fit models makes them sensitive to local complexities. If I want to distinguish a group of people, I don't need to start with a list of characteristics guaranteed to separate possible percepts of them. I just need an adequate level of experience of their faces in a context where there's reward for differentiating their identities. Different social actions are going to bring reward depending on which individual I'm interacting with, like calling them by the name if I recognize them. What will count as an adequate level of experience with a face isn't settled by its intrinsic character alone, but also by the context of other available faces. For example, if a person has a twin, you'll need more extensive experience with the pair of them before you can safely tell them apart. Those familiar with twins can have a heightened sensitivity to their small facial asymmetries and skin markings without needing to apply that particular sensitivity to every other face they encounter. Driven by local calculations, direct fit models enable tailored strategies for different identities. The local flexibility of direct fit models is attractive, but it should be underscored it doesn't constitute an advance guarantee of their success in any particular case. Given limits on our vision and processing, some very similar faces may remain indistinguishable for some of us, no matter how much data we gain. So if our face recognition works along the lines of a Voronoi tessellation, it's effectively one in which some anchor points pretty much coincide with each other. In addition, we may have to add new anchor points to the map as we go along. But again, thanks to the local character of direct fit models, the need for these new anchor points doesn't compromise the safety of our identification of individuals further away in face space. So, you know, discovering that Mary Kate has a twin doesn't threaten the safety of all your judgments about non-twins. Okay, despite occasional encounters with indistinguishable faces, the learning rule behind human face recognition seems to presuppose that for each new person we encounter, there's some many-to-one mapping, defining a zone of percepts that could come only from that individual. Learning what Idris Elba looks like, or coming to be able to recognize his face going forward, that's not the same as matching a single picture of him to that label. It's mapping this much larger zone of possibilities for him. The very idea that there is such a zone assumes that there is a type of percept that can only come from the face of Idris Elba. Direct fit approaches use this presumption across the board to drive the development and use of a set of dimensions powerful enough to map the contours of this type with the given data. Even if in some cases, truly indistinguishable twins, the presumption fails, as long as it's generally successful enough, it will continue to be applied. So in a learning context where Idris Elba is independently labeled, it may not matter whether we can recognize him on the basis of his facial characteristics. But in more interesting test contexts, he's not going to be independently labeled. And it's exactly because we keep facing such test contexts that we develop the capacity for face recognition. Given the importance of distinguishing individuals together with the facts about actual human facial distinctiveness, it pays off over time to identify individuals this way. And as we discover through trial and error that we're largely able to do so, this reinforces our tendency to differentiate people according to the infallibilist rule that there's a type of percept that can only come from the face of each individual. Because we learn from prediction error, the fact that we sometimes get things wrong drives learning of the specifics of faces and the dimensions individuating them, rather than dissuading us from continuing to apply the rule. The system incorporates some strong presuppositions. Human face recognition would collapse in a world with chaotic faces, suddenly rampant use of latex masks, or genetic changes leading to a population of faces whose individual differences were all too subtle for us to perceive. Ultimately, it's a somewhat contingent fit between characteristics of human faces and human cognition that enables the kind of safely individuating judgments of which typical humans are capable. Making a safe judgment of identity on the basis of some percepts is a matter of being sufficiently well adapted to local faces that these percepts fall within the zone uniquely picking out this identity. But again, because safety is local, it's not threatened by the merely hypothetical possibility that there might fail to be such a zone for this individual, or indeed any individual, under imaginative extrapolation to different circumstances. Finally, we get back to knowledge. So there's a parallel between the recognition of face and the recognition of knowledge. Knowledge can be uniquely characterized as the most general fact of mental state. On this view, to know is to be in the type of mental state whose distinctive character is that it can only be held towards truths. Learning the distinctive contours of this type gives us predictive power going forward. With sufficient experience, we can encounter a new case of this type and recognize the subject as knowing. Crucially, we can detect not only knowledge that P is the case, where P is independently known to be true, we can also detect knowledge WH, so you can see that someone knows who won the last World Cup and so on, when you don't know yourself. In the more interesting test contexts, where you have a question for someone else and they're knowledgeable, the key proposition's truth value isn't independently supplied, and it's exactly because you keep facing those test contexts that you develop the capacity for knowledge recognition. It pays off over time to recognize situations in which people have a state of mind of a type that you can only have to truths. And as you discover through trial and error that you're largely able to do so, this reinforces our tendency to seek out signs of those truth-anchored mental states in each other, whatever those signs might be. So this is where I have to pretend that I'm holding a coin. So, for example, from where you're now seated, you can see me as knowing whether this coin I'm holding in my hand is heads or tails, because I am at least pretending to instantiate a familiar pattern of perceptual access. Equally, you can see me as not knowing how many coins are in your pocket right now. And here again, you're doing so by evaluating this pairing of person and proposition as exemplifying a familiar pattern of ignorance. In a context where there's reward for distinguishing cases of knowledge from cases of ignorance, if you have adequate levels of experience with both types of case, and there are learnable regularities here, you're going to learn to distinguish them. Different social actions will win reward depending on the epistemic state of your target. So if you want to know which way the coin in my palm is facing, you can ask me. If you want me to know how many coins are in your pocket, you've got to show me or tell me. So basically, if a given agent, proposition pairing swiftly registers as closer to a prototype of knowledge than to any prototype of ignorance, the agent will be seen as knowing, and vice versa for ignorance. Again, so our intuitions don't entirely map the space of the open world. That's true for faces as well. Some people just register as strangers because we don't get a recognition for them swiftly enough. Many novel agent, comma, proposition pairings will not return any swift result either way, proximity to knowledge, proximity to ignorance. And those just register as open questions for which further investigation would be needed. So for example, you could ask me, do you know that person's name? Rather than just, what is that person's name? If you're unsure whether I know the stranger who's just entered the room, because you can be confident, relatively confident, that I'm going to know whether or not I know that person's name, even if I don't first order know that person's name. Okay, the system incorporates some strong presuppositions. Our systematic tendency to attribute knowledge presupposes that there really is a state of mind that subjects can only have to truths. This presupposition would collapse in a world with too much variation, either in objective reality or in the cognitive capacities of the subjects who surround us. As it is, the objective and cognitive regularities in our world enable us to have, and subsequently to detect in each other, patterns of knowledge or successful cognitive adaptation to reality. You can be mistaken about whether someone is successfully adapted on a given point, just as you could be mistaken in identifying someone who turns out to have a secret twin. But because we learn from prediction error, the fact that we sometimes get knowledge attributions wrong drives learning of the specifics of the dimensions separating types of ignorance from ways of knowing, rather than dissuading us from continuing to apply the infallibilist rule, that there's some kind of state that subjects can have only to truths. Actually, I want to take a second to really underscore that. There are other prototype-driven theories of knowledge recognition. So Goldman, 1994, has a theory like that, that you evaluate something as, you know, justified if it's closer to, or as knowledge, if it's closer to a prototype of reliably formed belief than to any unreliably formed belief. But I think it's much harder to get an error signal out of those, right? Because just discovering that you've gone wrong, that's something that can happen even if you followed a generally reliable way of thinking, right? Where if you insist that that you're measuring yourself against this infallibilist rule, you get a much stronger error signal. So any time you've gone wrong, you absolutely don't have a case of knowing. In any event, just as we learn to recognize a face by seeing it multiple times, so also we learn to recognize knowledge this way, going up a level. So in ordinary reinforcement learning, we get adapted to regularities in the world. One interesting set of regularities in the world is a set of ways in which creatures like us get adapted to regularities in the world. Through observation and social interaction, we get adapted to the adaptations of others, expecting them to know their own names, expecting them not to know how many coins are in our pockets. This is a high-dimensional problem, and it calls for massively parameterized computation. We couldn't hope to execute it in the kind of consciously available restricted capacity, working memory operation that we apply in logic or in mathematics. But because our adaptive learning mechanisms stabilize on representations that are safely correct, they can provide the kind of mapping of epistemic territory we need as a foundation for the testimonial transmission of knowledge. You trust a cooperative person on questions that you locate within her epistemic territory. If your sense of that territory is well-formed by your experience, you will gain knowledge by taking her at her word. You can also learn from her beyond that zone of instinctive trust, but beyond that zone, she's going to need to either direct your perceptual attention or reason with you explicitly in order to transmit what she knows. So in the end, epistemic territories are mapped like anything else, or as Sutra 2.119 puts it, ways of knowing are established like the light of a lamp. Next time, we'll try to use this fact to solve our problem from lecture one about the strange opposition between our two natural ways of thinking about knowledge. Thank you.